From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk suffixes. Now wait, does it end in ER or OR? We might have some answers. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. I'm ready for a fight. What about you guys? Not with you, but about words.
Oh, boy.
We're fighting with suffixes today.
Ooh. Fletcher, we're always ready for a fight.
Ooh.
We're tough.
Bring on that suffix. Bring on that prefix, too. I'm like,
Those Petras kids, yeah, they're always ready for a fight. We're talking about suffixes today and the battles between different kinds of suffixes that look the same but causes problems, I guess, maybe when we try to spell words.
Pretty much. That would be it, yeah.
But first we're going to talk about a prefix. Oh, Kathy, you wanted to say something first about pet peeves.
I did. I want to say this is the last call for pet peeves, kids. So if you want to get a pet peeve on the show, and we want you to get a pet peeve on the show, please send it in or email us or send a voice recording of what is your pet peeve. What are your pet peeves? We'll take 18 in one email. We're not picky. We're also peeved a lot, so we're happy to get them.
Preferably language pet peeves, by the way. I mean,
yes.
You're welcome to vent about whatever else you want, but that might not make it on the show.
This was an email from Rachel. So Rachel was saying she enjoyed hearing our pet peeves, and she was talked about a genuine fakes, and it said it reminded her of the unnecessarily extreme annoyance I feel. I did like this. When someone says things like, he has a fake watch, she said, the watch is really a watch. It's not really a Rolex brand watch. A knockoff watch is a watch. Fake should be applied to the brand. But anyway, she went on. I just love
our
listeners.
Right on that, but you hear it the right way when you hear it, though. Anyway.
But then she, of course, hates Between You and I, which we've talked about. But this is the one we want to address right now. My biggest peeve of recent times is different than. I hear and see it so much that it's completely infiltrated English, and I even hear it trying to come out of my own mouth, but I still feel that it is wrong. Different than versus different from.
I say different from, but we did a little study on it, and the Bank of English, Collins Bank of English, 30% use different than in speech. Only 7% use it in writing.
There's no way that's true. There's no way it's only 30%.
Very interesting. It could be. That's a couple of years old. And that percentage has been pretty much set since the early 1800s. Although another source says recently, different than has suddenly shot up in usage,
yeah.
Even in academic papers.
Without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt. I hear different than all the time. Like it's enough that I am not that bothered by it like Rachel is, because I hear it all the time.
I think I'm the same. I think you hear it much more. Then you also have, though, different to, which is a very British usage, mm-hmm. that I can't mm-hmm. think of. I've heard. Have you?
I've heard it. I don't hear people say it, but I've heard it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it. I don't think I would ever say that, though. I don't like different than. The problem with languages is not really that logical, different than, different
yeah.
from, different. I mean, technically you could argue different from is quote more correct. But I mean, English is such an illogical, I mean, language is so illogical that, you know, it's not a big deal to me, but it still wince when I hear it.
Well, here we go again, though. Who is responsible for why different from? Mm-hmm. Why is different mm-hmm. from other than different than?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Robert Baker again. Remember Robert Baker? We've mentioned him a few times. It was old Robert Baker in his book, Reflections on the English Language in the 1770. And he just decided that different than, a different mm-hmm. manner than is not English. We say different to and different from, the last of which expressions I have in another place, given the preference.
Although we, Mr. Baker, we don't say different to
That's
on
right.
this side of the pond.
That's right. So, you know, so why can't we say different than?
Yeah. It's just so funny.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I do say different from, and I guess I do notice, maybe I lied a second ago, I guess I do kind of notice when people say different than, even though it's said all the time. But also, I cannot imagine a real good reason to say one or the other, like to definitely say one or the other. So even if it bothers me, it's like it's one of those stupid things that bothers me. Sorry, Rachel. I mean, I don't mean that. That doesn't reflect on you. Regardless, it's one of those things where, like, when you really dig down, there's not a really good argument, in my opinion, for one or the other. So even if it does bother me when people say different than, that's me. That's my problem because there's not a real good argument, in my opinion, not to say different than.
Actually, grammarians in the 19th century tried to come up for a rule. Why than bad? You know, why bad than? And they said that than should only be used following a comparative adjective, something that would allow for an increase in a quality or quantity or relation.
Yeah.
And different is not a comparative adjective. Kathy's right.
Yeah.
So it would be smaller than and different from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is that
bigger
really,
than?
Is that really compelling, though?
Not really. Not to me.
It's an argument. But the one problem with language is it's custom, too. And we hear, like, for me, custom is different from. We can argue back and forth. Is this correct grammatically? Is this the reason grammatically? I hear different from as being correct or good English. I don't hear different than. But gradually, as we're talking, I'm beginning to hear different than. And I'm probably in 5 years, I'll be not great, you know, saying different than. Mm-hmm. Language changes.
I just want to say I was really proud when my daughter was, you know, 2 years old, and I was giving her a bath one day, and I noticed she said different from.
Good girl.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I mean, it's not like I ever said to her, you should say different from. It's just, you know, that's what I say, and that's what she picked up. And it just, it felt good that she was saying it correctly.
Yeah, but that is good.
Enough, I'm not sure if I don't even know which I use. I don't know if I do say different from, or do I say different than different from. He's different from.
I'm positive I say different from. That one I do.
Yeah, I think I say some. I think I do.
There's a quote here which I don't like, English Grammar for Dummies. Different than is never correct. What you want is different from. You can stop reading right here because you now have all the information you need. Now, that to me is a little bit too strong. I don't like different than. I don't, and I don't use it, but I don't think it's that big of a deal.
At this point, I mean, like, what is it doing to your sentence if you say different than instead of different from? Like, what is happening here with the communication other than we're getting all bothered about this word instead of that word? Like, what's happening? Mm-hmm. It's not even like a... you sound dumb or anything anymore because everybody says it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying this as somebody who is bothered by it. Like,
yeah, I just am
feel
too.
Like, I just feel like at this point it's a personal problem. You know, it's that I'm bothered by it. It's not something that people need to be worried about in any way.
Although if you have a question about it, I think, you know, when in doubt, I would stick with what different from.
Now we're going to like zip somewhere completely different. Just this just intrigued us. This is just a mini quiz for you, Fletcher.
Oh.
This is different from the other topic.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think the word rerun, R-E-R-U-N, first entered the English language?
Wow.
We're saying this might be a trick question.
Wow, I believe it is.
We're giving you four decades. 1940s. 1800s, 1930s, 1960s.
Right, because the only thing we think about with a rerun is television. And you said 1800s, the entire century? It could be anywhere in there?
Yeah, we'll throw the entire century. <that one.
laughs> Let's go.
We're liberal with that. Well,
yeah. Let's go with that.
I wasn't.
Let's go with the 1800s then. Why? I would have no idea unless you had like serials, like books that were coming out and somebody ran it again for some reason. But let's go with 1800s just because.
And you're correct.
Oh, okay.
And you're correct. It was done in reference to races.
Ish.
Races would rerun the race.
Oh.
Which would be that.
Oh, like, oh, wow.
But let's throw something else out. When did it come into as a noun for a film?
For like television
rerun
shows?
Rerun film. Before television.
Oh, okay.
That gives it away right there.
Yeah, but, why'd you do that, Ross?
I don't know. He asked the question.
You're just,
I answered
too
it.
Kind.
I know.
Was it one of those options that you gave me, or is it even earlier than the 1920s?
Yes.
Is it in the option?
Okay, then 1920s, I think, was the earliest one you gave me from the 20th century.
No, it was the 30s, but that's right.
Oh, really?
That's
the 30s. Right. I would have expected the 20s.
No.
I would have expected the teens, honestly.
It's the 30s.
Okay.
Ross gave that to you, so it doesn't count as a win. Does not get entered on your big score.
Yeah, but he got that. But he got the first one, which is a win. So I'm going to be kind.
But that was you. We did. Never mind. Yeah,
Fletcher is very able in this sense, which is a brilliant segue to Ible.
I think
though,
Rossi might be Ible.
Ible. We got an email from Judith in Raleigh. Hi, y'all. You've been talking about spelling the last few weeks. This is an older email. And for some reason, it made me wonder about the able and ible endings. There are a lot of words like walkable and thinkable, but then we have risible, visible, variable. It's hard to figure out if it's a matter of the preceding letter combos, keeping the root word prominent, or somebody's whim. Any
she
thoughts
knows
on this
us.
And all of your abundant free time? Well, I wouldn't call the free time that abundant, but she was joking. Thank you for sharing your interest and knowledge about English and a couple of bonus tongues. Judith, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thanks, Judith. You know, there's another word, two words, that use both of them, collectible. We see collectible spelled both ways all the time.
It's true.
That always
fascinates me. Now I've got to look it up.
Actually, I'm curious. How do you guys, that I see all the time too. I spell it a certain way all the time.
Well, there's two, to me, they mean two different things.
Oh, really?
Really? Oh, no, not at all. I mean,
collectible, a noun, is AB. Something is collectible, to me, is IB. That's in my head. I'm just saying.
Interesting.
Oh, I have it always as, to me at least, I always have it as IB. I hate AB for some reason. I have no reason why. I just don't like it. Fletcher, what's your collectible opinion?
It would be hard for me to care less.
Yeah, collectible usually, I'm just looking here, is attached to objects with appeal to collectors. Mm-hmm. A collectible is anything that you collect, they're saying.
That's really specific. That's getting really, I mean, that's like a distinction that's meaningless. I see it a lot because I, you know, buying books all the time. So I see the I usually more frequently than the A, but there's no real difference. The one thing is to answer Judith's question, though. The ible, I mean, we're going to go on to a long. You say collectible. The ible ending is for words of, pretty much exclusively for words of Latin origin.
I-B-L-E.
And there are about 100... I-B-L-E, mm-hmm. And there are about 180 of those words. And according to a lot of sources, no new words are being created with ible endings. The able, basically
takes...
Isn't
that also Latin?
A lot of it is Latin. Exactly.
Oh, good. But, well, I'm glad we've answered this question.
Isn't that helpful? But a lot of new words like, you know, I don't know. But
memeable. Something is memeable.
Yeah.
Right?
That's good.
A playable but foul ball, you know, that sort of thing can be, those are all found with A-B-L-E. When they make a new word up, it's A-B-L-E.
Mm.
Is that unlineable? Is that, you know, whatever. I don't think anyone would ever say unlineable, but now if they do, windsurfable. There we go. That's
windsurfable?
Sure. Is the sea windsurfable today?
You're really like clawing here, Ross, but I'll give you your windsurfing.
Yeah, but the point is, if you're going to spell, just think of this, you're going to spell windsurfable in your head. I'm spelling it with an A-B-L-E.
Yeah.
You know what I'm thinking more is absailable.
Oh, yes. Absailable, definitely.
You know, I mean, the A-B-L-E makes more sense because it's able to be windsurfed, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's windsurfable. So you're saying the I-B-L-E just is a set of words and it's just kind of hardened into that and there aren't any more I-B-L-E words happening?
Well, they're just when we make, you know, language is productive. Language keeps creating new words.
Right.
And when we do in English, there's no, you know, English has, of course, no grand, you know, Pooh-Bah who controls everything. But when it's done, it's almost A-B-L-E. There's a little trick, too.
I was going to say, are you talking about this rule that's not always a rule?
Yeah. Do you want to throw it in?
The rule, but it's a typical English rule. If you remove the able from a word, A-B-L-E, you're left with a complete word. Mm-hmm. Windsurfable, as in Ross's yes. case, windsurf. Absailable, absail. Affordable, afford. If you remove ible from a word, like sensible, you have sense, S-E-N-S. Mm-hmm. That's not a complete word. Mm-hmm. But, Ross.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, of course. That work is completely true, such as accessible, mm-hmm. contemptible, right. digestible. All of that violate, those words all violate that wonderful rule that we have.
What a rule.
So, I know. But it's a basic, also after the fact, after you've done it, you kind of go, well, you know, whatever. Just looking
never
up.
Never mind. Spell check. Yeah, I know. Right. I'm going to go windsurf now.
So, it sounds like the way to know is that you have to know it. You have to know mm-hmm. which words are I-B-L-E. I mean, if it refers to something very modern, it's very likely going to be A-B-L-E because it's probably a new word. But mm-hmm. otherwise, you just kind of have to know. Like, there's no real way to tell other than just knowing.
But that basic rule is usually fairly true. And we know a lot of the Ible words just by osmosis over the years. So it's not an amazingly difficult problem, I think.
Well, the fact that there are only 180, is that what you said, Ross?
Yeah.
Something like 180? That's not many when you think about like one's vocabulary. And I'm looking right now at words that end in ible, and a lot of these are not really words
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, exactly, Kat.
Like
That's right.
Cognoscible, adducible, istoincatable, no, non-controversial, never mind.
Bunch of letters.
Yeah.
And that led us quickly, I think we should go in before we get into the major part, though, of agentive subs. We talked about these before. The OR versus ER, we have the same problem. Like Fletcher, what's the difference between nouns ending in ER versus those in AR?
Oh, right.
OR, I mean.
Oh,
OR.
Right.
Where we
right.
talked about this. And Latin rears its ugly or beautiful, depending on your opinion on the beauties of Latin, head on this one, too. ER or OR endings for things like ball player, street vendor, or whatever. How do you know which is which? Which one to use?
All I remembered was that Latin had something to do with it. Is it?
It always does.
Is it the case that the OR words are more likely to have come from Latin-based words?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's another one of those almost always rules. Latin words which end in ate, A-T-E, take the suffix O-R. Dictator. There's mm-hmm. not dictator. Mm-hmm. Vendor.
Vendate?
Vendor doesn't end in ate.
Vendor. Vendate.
Senate. Senate. Sorry. Senate. Senator. The problem, it's funny, I'm doing pronunciation, I'm doing spelling pronunciation. I'm looking at the word Senate and I'm thinking Senate.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's just so odd. But yes, Senate ends in A-T-E. You have Senator. So yeah, it goes on from there.
Yeah, ER basically is more common in English, just like we were talking about able in English as well. And it usually, that seems to come from the Germanic roots, the Old English roots, etc. Drive, driver, run, runner, drink, drinker. And then the OR is basically, tends to be Latin. You don't spell driver, D-R-I-V-O-R, mm-hmm. etc. And that's pretty much does that.
I'm going to interject here now, but one of the rules, they always say that ER is almost always used when the verb involves usage of an agent or a doer. But then mm-hmm. I would argue that's the same with a lot of the OR ones.
It is. It's true.
So that just seems like so many words to me.
Yeah, like, as you know, we're Kathy and I are both authors, and we, you know, we very much auth.
We auth all yes. the time.
We auth all the time, yeah. But that, I mean, those rules are like, the problem with English really is you just got to learn it. It's, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those things. We have so many influences from so many places, mm-hmm. I guess in this case, Latin and Germanic, that it all jams up together and it's hard to know which is which. I guess, Ross, you knowing Latin, is it easier for you then just to know right away if one needs to be an OR?
It really helps. I mean, I think it helps just instinctively. Things look correct.
Yeah.
Or they look incorrect.
That makes sense.
But there are problems. Like, I mean, let me give you two. Here's one, but here's one that doesn't help at all. Computer. You can spell computer two different ways correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Computer and computor. So, you know.
Computor?
Yeah, computor is a common spelling of computer.
It is?
Look it up.
Computor? I've never seen that in my life. It's an archaic or obsolete spelling.
Yeah, but it's still a technically correct sort of thing. I mean, let me
give
you another.
Well, it's archaic. I'm sorry, Ross.
Think about it like this. If you were talking about a person who was computing something and you called them a computer and you were writing this down, how would you spell it?
I would spell it O-R.
Yeah, because we're not talking about a metaphorical thing here.
Yeah.
Like they are not a machine. They are someone who is computing, and you want to distinguish that from the machine, right?
Okay, I see what you're saying. I find that a little specious, but I'll give it to you.
But I'm going to give you another problem here. This was a woman who went to university in, there's a Canadianism, a university in the UK. And she was an advisor and a convenor. I don't know which one it is.
Advisor, I would do OR.
Okay, but she also had, when she was at UMass, it was advisor, OR. She goes to the University of Sussex and the University of Edinburgh, and it was basically split. ER versus IR was 50-50.
I see, because I would always think of advisor with an OR.
I would too.
Counselor. Is usually OR, right?
It's usually OR.
But now I'm looking, if you've got the double, can you do counselor with an E? Now I'm sorry, yes, counselor is a variant.
Yes, in American
English.
And
it's older.
Yeah. So we can, I mean, here we go again with this. Now we've given you a lot of useful advice, which is like, look it up in the dictionary quickly.
What was her name again? I'm sorry. You know.
Anyway, we're going to move on to eponyms.
This is something that both Ross and I love.
Okay, eponyms, Fletcher, do you know what they are?
Yeah, sort of. So a long, long, long time ago, we talked about the difference between eponyms or eponymous and titular, right? But I still can't remember quite which is which. An eponym is something that's named after a person. So, no, I was about to use the fake origin of crapper toilet.
that's actually one. It's a person, real or fictitious. The word
but
takes
no,
the
that's
name
not.
Of the person.
That's, but, right, that's a, not. That's a yeah. mythical that's, example.
And,
of
and it wasn't the
crapper
thing anyway.
Was not named after him.
Right.
Yeah, that was a mythical one. But the idea. No, I was talking about the idea of what an eponym is.
Okay, gerrymander. We had talked about that long
All right.
ago, didn't we? That's right. An eponym, is it not?
Is it? I mean, I know it's named after Elbridge Gerry, and it got turned into Gerry.
So it was. Right. That's an eponym. That's
okay, here's another one. And let's throw this one in. Boycott. Eponym or not?
Oh, right. I believe this is always assumed to be, at least that I remember seeing this as the commonly understood origin. So, I guess I'll say it is an eponym.
And you're correct.
Okay.
It came from the Captain Charles C. Boycott, a land agent of Loughmask. I'm pronouncing this wrong, I'm sure, because it's Irish. In County Mayo, who refused to lower rents for his tenant farmers.
I thought this was a really, I read up a little bit about it. I thought this was a fascinating word origin. The guy, I mean, basically, I didn't realize it, but Ireland was literally 90% of the land was owned by 0.1% of the population.
I'm not going to say something, but it's a correlation here. Go on.
Basically, the landowners owned the land and they gave tenants yearly leases, not 5-year leases, yearly leases.
Mm-hmm.
And if you couldn't pay, you could be just thrown off the land immediately. And Boycott basically was a land agent for an English lord in back, you know, I think in Dublin or whatever, who basically, the tenants asked for a 10% reduction, a 25% reduction. He only gave him 10%. So what happened was, this was the beginning of a huge movement in Ireland. People literally ostracized him. Everyone stopped dealing with him. That Charles Stuart Parnell, who was Irish, basically for Irish freedom, basically said, let's don't get violent. Let's basically shun these people.
Mm-hmm.
So boycott was shunned.
Yeah.
No one talked to him. And that's how the guy's name took on that ostracism.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
So like, I'm going to pull a boycott on you. I'm going to pull what we did on that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That is really interesting.
I love the fact that they said it was the word boycott was then adopted all around the world in newspapers. And they said in Japanese it was boycotto.
I know, I love that.
Boy, Cuttle.
And actually, I just found this. I'm going to read you the exact. I mean, this is weird because we have the exact origin, the date, this time of the origin of the word. There was a James Redpath who was a Scot who came over to the States, and then he went back to Ireland to report on the incident. And he was talking to a Father John O'Malley, who was one of the agitators against boycott. And Redpath goes, "I'm bothered about a word. What is it?" said Father John. "Well," I said, this is Redpath, "when people ostracize a land grabber, we call it social excommunication. But we ought to have an entirely different word to signify ostracism applied to a landlord or land agent like boycott. Ostracism just won't do. The peasantry is not going to know the meaning of the word. I can't think of any other." "No," Father John said, "ostracism won't do." He looked up. He looked down, tapped his big forehead, and said, "How would it do to call it boycott him?" Isn't that cool?
I love it. It's such a weird thing because boycott to me doesn't sound like a person's name. I mean, now that I'm hearing you use it as such, of course it does. But yeah, I always assumed it was some sort of portmanteau-y sort of thing that I had no idea about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Next, the word is dunce.
Dunce also sounds like an eponym. I don't remember ever hearing that it is. Seems like one of those things that I would have heard, but I don't know. I think it is. I think it is. Who is dunce? Tell me who dunce is.
John Dunce Scotus.
Scotus.
Scottish Scotus.
Scotus, yeah.
Okay, sorry, Ross. A Scottish scholar of philosophy and theology. His followers were in control of the universities until the Reformation. Then there was the whole reaction against everything. He was singled out as a hair-splitting scholastic, so all of his followers became known as dunces because they were following him. And then it spread just to mean anyone who was, quote, dull-witted.
Yeah, we've sold a lot of his books, actually, early editions of his books. I know him really well, in that
it's
sense.
It's funny. I wonder if, I mean, maybe the people buying your books would know, but I wonder how many people, you know, seeing that name, realize that that's where dunce came from.
I don't think many do. And also, his name was D-U-N-S, incidentally.
Oh, really?
And it changed to, yeah.
Okay.
Dunce Scotus, D-U-N-S Scotus, C-O, you know, S-C-O-T-U-S.
Uh-huh.
And then it changed to, in English, it changed to this U-N-C-E.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he was called the subtle doctor of the church, Doctor Subtilis, very subtle, because he was very, very persnickety.
We can't relate to that at all, I don't think.
No. He could be very, I mean, to read, he is very, in
dense.
Latin, he is... Dense is not the word. Yes.
Dunce.
Dunce is dense.
I sort of like how he looks. I mean, they always have those like solemn looking guys with the hats and stuff. It looks sort of cool.
I would never care for those pictures. Everybody always like looks.
Oh, really?
Like,
I love them.
I don't. They always look so tense and annoying. And
oh, really? It's so funny.
You don't want to sit and have a chat and a glass of wine with them. I don't know.
It's so funny because when I was a kid, we read, was it Rebecca? Which I always loved as the novel. And she mentioned looking at those medieval pictures and you just sort of want to fall. They always seem, I mean, they're not at all. They were very wild a lot of times, but they look kind of calm and wise to me.
I don't know.
I always was really interested in how they, I mean, I love medieval art personally. So I think it's a different thing, but Duns became, and then people got the idea of, because they were kids would be so like, you know, persnickety, they'd have to wear dunce caps and sit in the corner, which became a big thing too.
Dunce caps, though, were way later.
Oh yeah, much later.
Okay, Maverick.
Oh yeah, Maverick. Yeah, I think that's an eponym too. Are you just throwing all eponyms at me? This sounds. I think I do know. I think I do know that this is an eponym. I can't remember where it came from, but I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah.
Yes, it comes from Samuel A. Maverick. One of the sources says he's a Texas cattle owner, and he was very negligent about branding his calves. So the calves would wander around all the time, and basically you could round up a calf that wasn't branded, so he got kind of upset. And that's how the word came into being, as something that wanders around. He finally started realizing he better brand them. But the interesting thing was he really wasn't, they act as if he's a rancher. He was really more of a banker.
Hmm.
And he basically got these cattle and basically just didn't bother with it. Like, I wouldn't think automatically if I get a huge bound of cattle, do I have to brand them? I wouldn't know. Right. I don't know what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah, you trust, like, whoever is running your ranch or yeah. whatever. Yeah.
yeah. And basically what happened was, you know, he basically suffered by that. And the name stuck for, like, basically something that would wander around or be different.
Mm-hmm.
So it started out as, like, a calf or yearling found without an owner's brand. Then it became individualist or unconventional from the 1880s on.
I love the fact, though, that his grandson, Maury Maverick, became a congressman, a Democratic congressman, and he was also kind of like independent stuff, and he coined the term gobbledygook. His big mm-hmm. thing was hating the language in government, which he called gobbledygook.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, Kath and I got really into that. I mean, he was really big on basically trying to get a good, firm, good, straightforward English into government.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, he was a maverick, too, in that not only against gobbledygook, but against, he was the only liberal Southerner who voted against the anti-lynching bill many years, you know, which is, he was definitely a maverick in those days.
Yeah. Next word, martinet.
Oh, wow. Gosh, I've never thought about that. This one, it sounds like somebody's name. Why not? Let's make it somebody's name. Who is Martinet?
And you are correct. But this one really interested me. It came from a French military officer, Jean Martinet, killed at the siege of Duisburg in 1672. Supposedly he was a real pain in the butt. You know, strict discipline for the French regiment. Now, what, and it basically means, you know, someone who's a stickler for discipline. But what got me and Kathy both really interested was martinet is used in English,
mm-hmm.
but there's no French usage of the word as a disciplinarian. Isn't that cool?
Oh, wow, yeah.
Speaking of martinets, we also have marionettes.
All right, I'm gonna stop trying to discern a pattern here. You've given me only eponyms so far, but I'm not going to assume anything one way or the other. Marionette does not seem right. It does not seem like an eponym.
Okay, we were saying you're correct, sort of, but Ross, in fairness, it does mean little Mary.
Yeah.
So is this, we had, well, this as not I a mean... not an eponym, but it kind of is, because they used string puppets, you know.
Yeah.
To depict, especially to depict biblical events in the Middle Ages. And the Virgin Mary was obviously like a big, you know, one of the top stars, mm-hmm. thus marionette. So I would argue it is an eponym.
I would too. I think the only non-eponym we've mentioned today is crapper, with the, you know,
which we did, which was
which
not
we
on
did
the
last
list.
Time. Yeah, that wasn't on the list. But let's give it to Fletcher. Crapper. Let her say no. I think that's a, you know.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Cowell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.